Welcome to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. On this President's Day, we are rebroadcasting some of our favorite interviews. MacArthur Grant winner Emily Wilson is a professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania and the first woman to translate Homer's Odyssey, an interpretation which has won considerable acclaim. We'll discuss her work and what goes into the process of translating classical literature. Then the roots of Sacred Harp singing go back centuries, also known as shape note singing. The musical genre is enjoying a resurgence in this country. Thomas Ward is a local singer and chair of the recent Keystone Sacred Harp Convention. And finally, author Erica Armstrong Dunbar has written a biography of American heroine Harriet Tubman. Tubman helped to liberate hundreds of enslaved people and was a suffragette and spy for the Union Army. Armstrong Dunbar's book is She Came to Slay. Stay with us for Radio Times after the news on WHYY. Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For President's Day, we're bringing you some of our best interviews from past editions of the show. We begin with Emily Wilson, professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania. In 2019, she won a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship for her translation of Homer's The Odyssey from the original Greek into English. Wilson joined us last year to discuss the process and nuance of translating one of history's most venerated works of fiction. Let's listen. So let's talk about your work translating the Odyssey, Homer's classic story of the Greek warrior Odysseus and his 10-year journey home from the war in Troy to his wife Penelope. When was the Odyssey composed?
Every question you ask about the composition is going to be controversial. I think probably sometime in the 7th century. So the Greek-speaking world had no reading or writing for several centuries before the 8th century. And then at some point or other, probably fairly soon after literacy came to Greece, both the Iliad and the Odyssey were composed using writing.
So you were working with ancient Greek. Tell us about that language.
It's such a beautiful language. Yes, and Homeric Greek is unlike any other ancient Greek. It's a mix of different dialects from different parts of the Greek-speaking world. It's based on this very, very long oral tradition. So it's an amalgam of different dialects, different phrases that have developed over time through this folk poetry tradition. So it's a wonderful, Homeric poetry is a wonderfully rhythmical, metrical, kind of discourse that has these resonant phrases like rosy fingered dawn, which keep coming up over and over again. It's a beautiful language.
So in translation, the correct interpretation of just one word can apparently make all the difference in the world in the understanding of a character's nature. In a New York Times article about your work in the Odyssey, you talk about the first adjective to describe Odysseus, polytropos. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's fine. Yes.
Okay. Which can be interpreted and was interpreted in a number of different ways. Tell us about that and your work in interpreting just one word so that you got your impression of this folk hero correct.
Sure. I mean, I guess I would take issue with the idea that there's a correct interpretation of any word, any literary text, right? I mean, of course, a poem has multiple different things it can be saying, right? And there isn't a single interpretation that's right. There's a range of things that could be possible interpretations. So Odysseus is a very unusual kind of Homeric hero. Unlike Achilles, who's always swift-footed, he's always going as fast as possible towards death. Odysseus is always multiple. So all of his epithets, almost all his epithets, have to do with his multiplicity. His poly, as in polygamy, right? It's to do with manyness. So in the first line of the poem, he's polu tropos, many turny. And of course, many turny isn't an English word. So I didn't want to write in words that are not English words. I wanted to convey some meaning, as I think the original does convey some meaning. It seems to me that epithet, it speaks to multiple different things. It speaks to Odysseus's own multiplicity, to the multiplicity of the journey that he goes on, that he's being turned around constantly. He's trying to get back home to Ithaca. He does this circular journey from Ithaca to Troy and back, but then he keeps going on loops and meanderings of being lost, being driven off course. And I think it's also a way of speaking about the poem itself, that it's a poem which has multiple layers in it. So I chose the word complicated to render it, to hint
as an adjective to describe him.
To describe Odysseus, mm-hmm. But I wanted to choose a word that could also apply to the poem itself, that could invite the reader to think about complexity, to realize that even though this is a very, very ancient poem, it's not a simple, primitive kind of poem. It's about a complicated hero, a complicated protagonist, and a complicated picture of society and of what it means to be in a community.
How long did it take you to do the entire translation? And also, how long might it take you to translate one word or one phrase till it becomes what you want it to be or envision it to be?
The whole project took 5 years, and I at many points thought there's no possible way I can do it in 5 years, and I'm going to need to beg for another decade, because it could easily expand to fill as many years as I had. I would very often be in the position of thinking, the Greek is crystal clear, I have no problem understanding any of the words, and yet I just don't see how to put it into English in a way that's going to convey that clarity. I would be constantly getting stuck on things I didn't think I would get stuck on. It wasn't like, because this is polytropos is a long word, are the long words going to be harder? No, very often the simple, easy words are the hardest.
Well, who have you determined Odysseus to be?
Well, I've already said multiplicity is so important, right, that he's always pretending to be somebody else. So if somebody's essence is about being somebody else all the time, then what's the real him? Maybe the real him is, as he says to the Cyclops, I'm nobody. Maybe he is nobody, and maybe that's actually who he is. Or maybe when he comes back to Ithaca, he tells several different false sort of biographies where he says, I actually come from Crete and I'm this wheeling hustler kind of guy. And maybe those are also true selves.
He's complicated.
And he's also a different person in each of his relationships. I think that's one of the things that's very interesting about the depiction of homecoming in this poem, is that it's not just about being in a physical place. It's also about the different relationships that Odysseus reestablishes with each member of his household. He's somebody different with his wife from the person he is with his enslaved swineherd. The person he is with his dog is different from the person he is with his poor bullied young son, different from the person he is when he's bossing his men around to get them to row him back to Ithaca.
His voice is not necessarily the primary voice. If I'm understanding some articles I read correctly, there are definitely voices of women, Penelope, mm-hmm. but also the females who live with her. And this was another interesting translation that you made of the word to describe them, as opposed to what other translators came up with. You know, slaves, housemaids, whores, mm-hmm. As some translations call them. They meet a grisly end at the hands of Telemachus. Mm-hmm. Your translation of the description of these women in Penelope's household is telling. What do you call them?
I call
girls,
them
I believe.
Women, girls, and slaves. It's been striking to me to realize, I mean, not, this doesn't just apply to women, but to enslaved people who are both male and female, that quite a lot of translators into English and also into other languages tend to present the enslaved people as servants, which I think is to do with we're so uncomfortable with the idea of an enslaving society that we actually want to erase it from the classics, yeah. Even though, in fact, of course, antiquity was a slave-owning society. So when Odysseus gets back home to Ithaca, he slaughters all the suitors who've been harassing poor Penelope for the last few years. And then he delegates the final set of killings, the murder of the 13 slaves who've been claimed by the suitors of his wife.
These women, yeah.
These women and one man. So there's 12 okay. women and one man who've been claimed by the suitors. And he tells Telemachus to hack them to death with swords. Instead, Telemachus decides that he's been this dopey kid up to this point. He takes initiative and decides that instead he's going to hang the women, and then they chop off the hands and feet and genitalia of the man. So I think it's the scene that's to do with claiming ownership of bodies that have been claimed by the other men, and that it's a kind of honor killing. It's about the restoration of honor. And it seems to me that some interpretations, including translations, present it instead as a scene of enacting justice, which
yes,
isn't
the,
how
the
I
word
would.
Whore is used, yes. But you do not use that.
No, so and the Greek doesn't use any equivalent.
Okay.
So it's just that I'm not putting in an element of that kind of judgment where I don't think the Greek text is doing that.
Okay. So the Odyssey is a 12,110-line epic poem originally written in, and I hope I get the pronunciation here correct, dactylic hexameter?
Yes.
Oh,
well done.
Okay. Yes. Your translation is an iambic pentameter. Is there an easy way to describe this sort of transformation for a fairly short radio segment?
Well, it was essential to me to use regular audible meter because, as I've said, it's a poem based on an oral tradition. It has this regular rhythm to it. It was performed out loud. I wanted to invite the modern reader to either read out loud or at least just hear a beat in her head. And it seemed to me that the only way to do that is to use a native Anglophone meter. And obviously, iambic pentameter is the meter that's run through English poetry for the last few hundred years. So I wanted not to do what I think many translators into English have done in contemporary times of using either prose or free verse. I wanted it to have a very clear rhythm. The fact that I was translating from a longer line, a hexameter, which has 6 feet, into a pentameter, which has 5 feet, and I also wanted to keep up the pacing by keeping the same number of lines, it meant that I then also used quite a lot of fairly short words. And I felt that the clarity of that was actually truthful to something in the original. The original has this kind of clarity that I hoped I could get through that way.
Did you run into some real challenges in trying to make
it? Oh, yes, I did.
I imagine you did.
It was tough, yes. Yeah. But it was a fun kind of tough, yeah.
So your readers, if you're going to spend a lot of time on phrases and maybe on one word, how do you want people to approach the Odyssey?
I think it's a poem that you can read at any pace, any state, any speed, any time of your life. I mean, I've heard from a lot of readers who say that they found my version a real page-turner, and they were surprised to realize that they actually, you know, stayed up late flipping the pages, and they got through it much faster than they thought. I don't feel betrayed by that. I think that's a good thing. I mean, in antiquity, people presumably very often just heard a huge chunk of it over the course of drinks and dinner. I didn't intend for it to be a kind of text where you would have to pause to puzzle and figure out what exactly does that sentence mean, which I don't think the original is. I wanted it to feel like you want to know what happens next. It's exciting.
You are the first woman to publish a translation of the Odyssey into English. This is a male-dominated field?
The translation of ancient Greek and Roman texts is a very male-dominated field, and it's surprising because, of course, there are many female classicists and there are many translations of the Odyssey into other languages by women. But there are little pockets of classical studies that are still extremely male-dominated, and this seems to be one of them. And I think it's also to do with how people think about translation, that we tend to think it doesn't matter who a translator is because you just want the correct interpretation. But in fact, the interpretation is going to depend on who you are, where you're coming from, both in terms of what you've read before and also what your life experiences
are.
There's no one correct interpretation.
Your parents are both academics.
No, there's just one of them.
Your mother is an academic. Your dad's an author.
My dad's a writer, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, so how have times changed for you and your work as compared to your mother's era?
Both in every possible way and also not entirely, right? I mean, I think there are still gaps in terms of how many women versus men get the big tenure track jobs, the big prizes, all those kinds of things. I was the founding member of the Somerville Creche at Oxford. My mother's taught for all her career at a historically women's college in Oxford, which is now not a women's college anymore. I think just in terms of work-life balance and childcare and maternity leave policies, there are some positive changes, but I don't think we've solved everything for sure.
What drew you to classical literature?
So many things. I mean, when I was 8 years old, I played Athena in the elementary school play that my school had, and that got me excited about Greek myths in general. I started learning Latin in high school, and I loved the structure of the language. I loved the clarity of the way that it laid out patterns of how is a sentence built. I also loved, right from the beginning, how the literature, the texts that you could read once you started learning Latin and Greek was these really complicated, I mean, maybe coming back to the word complicated, these complicated depictions of society and of human emotions that were still so vivid even after 2,000 or 3,000 years, that you can have this access to cultures that are both entirely different from ours and also we can understand them.
What are the similarities between those cultures and today?
We still have wars. We still have inequality. We still have feelings. We still have complicated relationships with each other. We still struggle to form communities, to talk to each other across gaps of differences of culture, differences of power, differences of agency.
So humans haven't changed all that much.
Humans have changed radically and also not. Both things are true. Yes.
Was our conversation with Emily Wilson, professor of classical studies and graduate chair of the program in comparative literature and literary theory at the University of Pennsylvania, speaking with us about her translation of Homer's The Odyssey. When we get back from the break, we'll learn all about one of America's oldest forms of music, sacred harp singing. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The song you're hearing is called Exumeo, and it comes from the Sacred Harp Songbook. As I've been told, recorded versions of this music don't do justice to actually participating in and hearing sacred harp singing live. Sacred harp singing, also known as shape note singing, has been in existence in this country for centuries. The concept is beautifully simple. It's communal, the musical structure is relatively uncomplicated, anyone can participate, and many who do say it can be transformational. Earlier this year, we invited Philadelphia-based sacred harp singer and organizer Thomas Ward to tell us more about the history and revival of sacred harp. Let's listen. I must be living in a bubble because when our producer John Ahrens pitched this as a show idea, I'd never heard of it.
Hmm.
But it is among the oldest forms of music in this country, and it is enjoying quite a revival.
It definitely is. And it's funny that you should describe your experience that way, because that was kind of my experience of it. It was sort of on my radar for a long time. I kind of vaguely knew about it, but I had no idea that it was this living tradition. And I actually had a CD with some shape note music on it, and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. I wonder if people still sing this. And I Googled it, and lo and behold, on my block, there was a regular singing that week. And so I just went along and kind of never turned back.
So you walked in the door, mm-hmm. and you saw people singing, and you were probably welcomed in. My understanding mm-hmm. is that this is just, it's an open arms type of gathering.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You can really sing well or not, right?
Yeah. In fact, some would say that singing well is not necessarily a good thing in the traditional sense. I think a lot of the way that we sing goes against a lot of what people who are classically trained might be told to do. It's not about making a pretty sound. It's about being involved and participating. So yes, we say that no experience is necessary. There are no performances, no rehearsals, and no judgment, as one of our singers said to me yesterday, actually, of singing.
So. And yet when I've heard clips, it does sound good.
Oh, well, that's good. Nice to say. Nice to hear. Yeah.
Let's talk about how this works. Shape notes.
Yes.
Help us to visualize mm-hmm. what this is if we are looking at the songbook.
Right. So shape note, the phrase shape note refers to, in fact, a printing convention. And it's actually, there's some debate about when this convention was invented, but one account puts it in Philadelphia around 1800. And it's a style of printing music in four-part harmony that is aimed to help people who don't have training in reading music.
Okay.
And so if you can picture a score of music with the sort of round, most traditional music has round note heads.
But like a little flag on top.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But with shape note music, the note heads are different shapes. They're actually four different shapes.
Triangle.
Yes, a triangle, a square, a circle, and a diamond. And it's a little bit, it's slightly complicated to explain, but basically those shapes refer to steps on the scale. So it's meant to sort of help people be able to pick up music and sight read it very quickly without having to have intense training. And that is actually, it's interesting, people who have absolutely no background in reading music often pick it up more easily, whereas I actually came to it having had experience in singing choir and playing the piano, and I sort of had to learn how to incorporate this new piece of information, which is the shapes, you know, into my reading of the music.
How does the actual group singing work? There's no conductor.
That's right.
There's no audience. Mm-hmm. There are no instruments. Right. So what are the mechanics there?
Yeah, or you could put it the other way, that we are all of those
things.
You are
everything. Right?
Yeah, okay. So we sit in a square. We face each other. You've got the basses on one side, the sopranos, who we actually call trebles, on facing them, and then on the other two sides of the square, the tenors and the altos. And we face each other, and usually what happens is we take turns. People just pick a song and say, I'd like to hear, you know, number 33 on the bottom of the page, and everyone opens the book, and we sing that song, and if we get it right, we get it right.
There is a leader.
There is a leader, yes.
And you kind of rotate that out.
Exactly.
Right?
And that person stands in the middle of the square, and usually the way it works is he or she waves their arm and kind of to keep time in a sort of simple way. And actually, people in the square will follow along, also waving their arms to keep time. But people sometimes who come not having been before are sort of wondering what's going on, why is everyone waving their arms around.
It's called beating time,
beating time.
I read.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's just to keep everyone kind of together. We sing for ourselves, and, you know, sometimes people ask me, oh, when do you perform? And we don't perform. We just get together and sing together.
What is the Sacred Harp Songbook? Because this is at the heart of much of this.
That's right. So the Sacred Harp Songbook was first published in, I think, around 1844 and has been updated continually since then. The most recent edition, which is the one that we sing out of, is from 1991. But it really is just the most popular shape note book. There are others. There's one called the Shenandoah Harmony, which is a newer one that was actually put together by some people who also sing in Philadelphia. And then, you know, there are also other shape traditions. So we ours is a four shape tradition, and there's also a seven shape tradition, which is it's the same principle. It's just mm-hmm. the shapes correspond to the scale steps in a slightly different way.
I'd like to get to a clip in just a moment,
sure.
But first, you know, there are Christian roots definitely to the sacred harp music, but all are welcome.
That's right. Yeah.
Just to clarify.
That's right. And so another thing, if you were to show up at a singing, the music is largely Christian, but people from all sorts of backgrounds come. A lot of people who are entirely secular. It's not about proselytizing or faith in that way. So I think that's an important thing to
clarify.
We'll
talk about the experience in just a mm-hmm. moment. But because sacred harp singing is sung by so many singers sitting in the round, it is known as difficult to record properly. One of the best attempts at a professional sacred harp recording was made for the 2003 Civil War movie Cold Mountain. Here is that recording of the song Idumea, credited simply to the sacred harp singers.
Oh,
is the sensation of being inside something like this, Thomas Ward, when you are in a group singing this music? How can you describe it?
I can try. And I mean, I should say it's very different for different people. Some people connect very much to the words. For some people, the words are not that important. It's the music. I think it may be fair to say that the community is a huge part of it. The feeling that you're with a group of people, whether it's a very small group. I mean, that was quite a large group that was singing, and often the group are very large, especially at that big sort of convention type situations. But it's, I think a feeling of belonging to a group and creating something together as a group that isn't for sale. It isn't for other people. It isn't not for other people. It's just we're doing it together, and it's not. We're not doing it as a performance. We're just kind of doing it for each other.
It sounds as if it can be transporting. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. It absolutely can. I mean, there sometimes is a sense that you sort of you blend into the crowd, and you really. I've been in situations where we'll all kind of start singing a song, and as a group, we kind of make a decision to sing it in one way or another, and it's not necessarily the leader who's making that decision. We're all.
You just kind of go with the flow as a group. You're making a decision. You sense it from your fellow singers.
Yes, or the collective mind kind of takes over, and I think that's it's not about being. A performer in that way, and it can be very transporting, and sometimes it can take you by surprise. You'll be singing a song that you've sung 100 times, and the words will suddenly say something new to you that you had never experienced before.
About some of the common themes of the lyrics. Mortality
absolutely
is a big one.
Yes.
I mean, some of these lyrics were written like a few centuries ago, and it was much closer to people back then than perhaps it is in today's culture.
Absolutely. That clip that you just played, I mean, the lyrics are, "And am I born to die and lay this body down? And must my trembling spirit fly into a world unknown?" Which I think for a lot of, you know, people that very explicit sort of discussion of death, which occurs in the lyrics, can be troubling and surprising and alarming. But I think that is also one of the things that a lot of people who sing kind of connect to. I should say it's not all, you know, dark and scary, you know,
sure.
Sort of things like that. But that is an element of the lyrics.
So there was a revival of this music genre. I think it was in New England in the late 60s, which was characterized then by a cultural exchange with the South, which is where these – are they all called singings? That's generally when you get together, it's called a singing?
A singing, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I've read that Southern singings are considered to be a bucket list item for many people. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, lots of people have very different relationships to this music. And I came to it about 9 or 10 years ago. And so I wasn't, you know, part of that. I mean, people who were doing that revival in the 60s, you know, that was before I was born. And so they would be able to speak more to what that was like. I think there among some singers, there is a sense that the South is kind of where it is the authentic. But I think that a lot of people have also kind of begun to, you know, try to nuance that idea, because after all, a lot of the music actually comes from New England in the first place. And I mean, the thing about this also that should be said is it brings together a lot of different strands and traditions. And so there's the sort of Southern strand, there's a New England strand, you know, there's older music, there's more modern music. Music is continuing to be written actually for the tradition. So there are, you know, active composers who are still writing this kind of music that they bring to singings and try them out at singings.
And if you look at a group of people in a singing, you'll find a fascinating a bunch of different types of folks from all walks of life. Tell us about that.
That's right. And I mean, that's kind of...
Describe a singing for us.
Sure. I mean, you'll see the kind of tattooed, you know, pierced city folk, and some, you know, we have some plainclothes people, sort of Amish and River Brethren type people who sometimes come to singings, older, younger. So it is a really interesting range. In fact, one thing that strikes a lot of people is just how there are all these like young people who seem very like kind of punky people. Like, what are they doing singing this apparently very religious music? It's
what do you think they're doing there?
You know,
people in there say they're 20s and, you know, maybe early 30s.
I think it depends on who you ask, and I wouldn't want to speak for those people.
Sure.
I mean, I think I've heard from some people that it's about connecting. I think a lot of it is for a lot of younger people, it's a kind of anti-commercialist sort of thing as well, because I mean, you can buy recordings of it, but I mean, there's an old joke that you might drive for 5 hours to sing in a Sacred Harp singing, but you wouldn't cross the street to just listen to it or pay to go. You'd never pay to go to a performance, you know? And so it's
more
not
about the experience of being inside.
Exactly. It's not about producing a product in that sense. And I think that appeals to a lot of people who are sort of tired of the kind of commercialization of music.
Was our conversation about one of the oldest forms of American music, sacred harp singing, with local singer and organizer Thomas Ward. When we get back from the break, we'll talk with writer Erica Armstrong Dunbar about her latest book on the life and times of Harriet Tubman. Stay close. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is a significant cultural moment for Harriet Tubman. The first feature-length biopic about the legendary Underground Railroad conductor opened last fall to sizable crowds. The Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park was established in Church Creek, Maryland. There's a movement to place her image on the $20 bill and much more. The woman nicknamed the Moses of her people was born in 1820 and lived a full 91 years. Her achievements were extraordinary and at times have attained an almost mythical status, but there are other facets to Harriet Tubman few of us know of. For instance, she was a spy for the Union Army and a fierce advocate for women's rights. Erica Armstrong Dunbar is a National Book Award nominee and author of the new biography, She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. Armstrong Dunbar joined us late last year to talk about Harriet Tubman and her lasting legacy. Let's listen. So the author's note, which opens your book, in that note you write, paraphrasing, that Tubman is remembered as she should be, as a heroic conductor for the Underground Railroad, but you wanted to present a multidimensional story. There was just a lot about her, some significant achievements, which have received little attention.
Yeah, you know, I wanted readers to really understand Tubman beyond what they see in their high school history textbook, that one page that might be dedicated to her or the pictures that we see of her during Black History Month, and to really be able to think of Tubman not just as a sort of elderly woman, head covered, hands clasped, but to think about her as an enslaved child, as a young woman, a woman, enslaved woman who found love, who married, and to think about her in the Civil War as the first woman to lead a military expedition, and of course beyond her work with women's suffrage and her work as a social activist for the elderly, and to do all of this as a person who lived with real physical challenges, as really with a disability.
When she was a teen, she suffered a terrible blow to the head. This likely induced a form of epilepsy.
Yeah, we don't have, of course, there was no real medical term for it back then, but she got in the way of a dispute with an overseer who was attempting to reclaim another person, another man, when he asked her to step in and help him sort of tie this person down. She refused. allowing the man to run away. And in his rage, he picked up a 2-pound weight, hurled it at her head, and fractured her skull. And she would live with headaches and basically narcoleptic sleeping spells for the rest of her life.
But they produced visions.
They did. And she talks about this as later on in her life as a sort of as a gift from God. It was definitely something that was a disability, but it was also something that gave her, as she said later on, visions and sort of feelings about the right ways to move while she was on the Underground Railroad, sort of intuition about what was right and what is wrong. And she always credited God for her decisions and the fact that she never lost one person on her during her time on the Underground Railroad. Mm.
We've got a clip from the movie Harriet, in which Leslie Odom Jr., as he plays William Still, an African-American abolitionist, he questions Cynthia Erivo, I believe her name is pronounced, she's playing Harriet Tubman, about the danger of Tubman's work and her abilities. Let's listen.
Rescuing slaves requires skill and careful planning. It requires reading, Harriet. Can you read a sign or a map? Can you read it all?
I put my attention on trying to hear God's voice more clearly.
Do you know what would happen if you got caught? They would torture you until you pointed them right to this office. You got lucky, Harriet. And there's nothing more you can do.
Don't you tell me what I can't do. I made it this far on my own. God was watching, but my feet was my own. Running, bleeding, climbing, nearly drowned. Nothing to eat for days and days, man. I made it. So don't you tell me what I can't do.
Erica Armstrong Dunbar, as you write, Harriet Tubman was only 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And again, she could not read or write, but she did have a compass. She knew about the North Star. What made her so tough?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm not certain that any of us really can fathom that level of courage, strength, physical strength. I think that's one of the things we see in the movie that's quite moving, that we understand the physical stamina required to travel over 100 miles from the eastern shore of Maryland to Philadelphia over 13 times. And, you know, I think what I try to say in the book is to remind folks that in many ways, the physicality of slavery, the physicality of the duties that she was required to complete, in many ways prepared her to be the gladiator she probably didn't know she'd be.
Well, let's go back to her time as a child. Mm-hmm. She was, how old was she when she was first lent out by the family which enslaved her to other families to do work?
Yeah, she's only 5 or 6 years old.
Unbelievable.
She's separated from... I mean, we see it as unbelievable, but it was actually very typical for what was happening on the Eastern Shore in the 1820s and 30s, that there wasn't a need for hundreds and hundreds of enslaved people on these smaller farms. And so in many ways, her life is typical of slavery in rural areas that don't have the mythic large plantations. So at 5 or 6, before she has a set of adult teeth, she is hired out. She sleeps on the floor. She's emptying muskrat traps with her little hands in frigid waters.
She's not clothed properly either.
No, none of them were at this point. They're not clothed properly. They're not fed properly. She doesn't have a bed. She sleeps on the floor. And she's ill constantly. She gets the measles and she's still expected to work. And so in many ways, you know, this is the violence of slavery that we see through Tubman's life, and her childhood represents childhood in slavery.
She had a close family and she was born Araminta Ross.
Correct.
What forces shaped her views on enslavement from what you can see in the research that you did?
Yeah, you know, I think that every enslaved person knew that slavery was wrong and knew that there was a higher power, something above the law. But she, Araminta, understood that, or perhaps it was her visions, perhaps it was from suspicion or rumors. But she didn't think that something was right with her family. And so she grew older. She hired herself out. Her owner allowed her to do this. She saved money. And she saved money not for clothes or whatever. She paid an attorney to go track the records of her family. And what she finds out is that her mother had been promised her freedom at the age of 45 in a will, and that the family had ignored it. And not only was her mother to receive that, but all of her children were to receive it as well. So Araminta was supposed to be free at 45. I mean, that's a very long time in the antebellum era. That's old age. Mm. But still, She knew the family had ignored it and knew that there would be really very little chance for her to ever find her own freedom.
And she watched people she loved being sold to other families.
She did. The three of her sisters were sold to the Deep South, and this was very familiar, a familiar story for enslaved people in the antebellum era, down to the growing new states of Mississippi and Alabama, where cotton production was necessary and required by slave owners. So she lost her three sisters.
How did she become Harriet Tubman?
Yeah. When in 1844, she marries a free black man by the name of John Tubman. And there's some discrepancy with historians about when she actually takes the name Harriet Tubman and leaves behind Araminta Ross. I tend to believe or err on the side of she chose Tubman as a last name when she married her husband, John Tubman. And she took the name Harriet, which was her mother's name. And so we believe that she really did that prior to, this is something slightly different than what we see in the movie, but she does it prior to arriving in Pennsylvania.
So when she was about 27, she makes a solo bid for freedom. It's not her first bid, but it's a solo bid. Tell us about that.
Yeah, she actually sets off in September of 1849. She has a feeling, a premonition, because she had been ill for some time, that she was actually going to be sold. She knew this was her moment. And she, along with two brothers, attempt to run away. And to make a very long story short, her brothers, they chicken out. And they return. And they drag.
There was a lot against them, though.
Oh, they were illiterate. It was cold. It was sort of dealing with the darkness, not being able to read signs or anything. And they decided that it would be better to face punishment at home than the unknown. So they drag Harriet back, and she makes the decision, I can't live this life. And it's sometime after October that she does make this solo run and reaches the border of Pennsylvania on her own.
Most fugitives were men, and for Harriet, the fact that she had no children turned out to be a blessing. Why?
Yeah, I think for those of us who study enslaved women, we know that part of the reason the number of fugitive men is much higher than women is because so many women were tied to their children and did not want to leave a farm or a plantation or home where their children would be left behind. Tubman had no children with John Tubman, and in some ways that, I don't want to say it freed her up, but it let her not have the same kind of feelings of guilt.
And fear.
And fear. Yeah. And also gave her, but she did have empathy because a number of the people that she ferried to freedom were women.
She could not turn away a mother with an infant.
She couldn't.
An infant could be a liability.
Of course.
Because they cry.
Babies cry all the time. There's no way to prevent that, especially when you're cold and hungry and in the woods. And so she actually drugged the babies, and she used.
With what, do we know?
Yeah, we do. There's a form of medication called paregoric, which is an opioid. I remember taking it when I was a child for stomach aches, but in large doses, it would quiet the children. And so she would do that. She would drug the babies, put them in a basket, and carry them north.
Mm. Erica, and we don't have a whole lot, so much to talk about here, but I'm just curious about the research you did into a woman who lived so long ago, and finding the meticulous detail that you presented in the book. What did you look into? Where'd you go for that?
Yeah, now in some ways I'm really fortunate that there are a good number of biographies about Tubman that exist. I do believe that I'm the first black woman historian to write a biography of Tubman on a major press. And so, I relied on some of my biographer friends who've written on Tubman, Catherine Clinton, Kate Clifford Larson, but also reading through her own supposed testimony that was written in 1869 by Sarah Bradford. And so reading her words and also sort of asking myself, okay, Erica, what do you bring to Tubman's story that's new? We haven't had a biography of Tubman in over a decade. And I wanted to bring something that was accessible and that was modern and would bring a modern reader to her story, a story that seems long ago and far away. And that's why I titled it She Came to Slay.
Which she's fearless.
Yeah.
Yeah. She became a Union spy during the Civil War. I hadn't, the little bit of history I learned, I never knew that. And this is when she was dubbed a Black She Moses by a reporter from the Wisconsin State Journal, as you write. Tell us just a bit. We don't have that much time.
Sure.
About her mission on the Combahee River?
Combahee River, yes.
Combahee River, deep into Confederate territory.
Yeah, she's actually asked by, this is in 1862, she's asked by the governor of Massachusetts to go down to be a spy and a scout. And she arrives in South Carolina, and eventually she, after a little bit of time, she figures out who her allies are, and she learns where all of the torpedoes have been planted on the river by the Confederates. And so, and of course, who's telling her this? It's enslaved people, right? Because they're the ones that planted the torpedoes. And so she's able to literally maneuver gunboats, Union gunboats, up the river and to surprise the Confederates while they're sleeping in the early morning hours in June of 1863. And not only does she run off the Confederates, but she, in one fell swoop, she manages to liberate over 700 enslaved people in South Carolina.
Getting them on the boat.
She does. She gets them on there, bringing everything with them that they have, and she brings them to Union lines, to freedom.
And another fact about Tubman, again, that's not widely publicized, is that in her 60s, she began to actively advocate for women's rights and the right to vote.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that we really sort of, that this isn't just a sort of small moment of Tubman. I think as we move into 2020, a year where we celebrate 100 years of suffrage, that Tubman is a part of that story. She forms friendships with women who were well known in the suffrage movement because they were all abolitionists.
Right. But while there were also tensions between white and black.
Indeed.
And then the movement.
She really was one of the few who was able to walk the line, to hold on to her relationships with white women, and to be revered and respected and a part of black women's suffrage movements. And it was a tricky time, a difficult time. And we could argue there's vestiges of that today.
Hmm. Have you had a chance to see the movie,
Harry?
You have? What did you? Does it tell the story as you feel it should?
So, you know, I'm one of those cranky historians, but I will say I think it's a wonderful film and that people should go see it. I'm super impressed that it was written, directed, produced by black women. And I think that's a feat that we have to respect and admire. And hopefully we'll see more people having the opportunity to tell these stories.
As you write, Erica, we don't know how Tubman would have celebrated the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. How do you imagine that she did, which, of course, prohibited slavery?
Oh, I think, you know, the first thing that comes to mind, of course, is she got on her knees and thanked her God. And it was her fierce relationship with God that she always credited to any success that she had. So, you know, she knew the people who were involved in the work of anti-slavery, but it was really her God that ended human bondage.
Is there a story regarding Tubman's trips to free enslaved people that affected you in particular?
Yeah, you know, I think that it was perhaps because I am a mother, that it was the stories of her rescuing children, women with children. And one of her first missions actually wasn't to the Eastern Shore, it was to Baltimore. And it was because she knew that her niece and her children were going to be sold. And she orchestrated the first escape that she would lead. And for me, it's sort of thinking about a woman who gave everything for everyone moves me every time.
And that wraps up this President's Day edition of the Radio Times Regional Roundup. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and John Ahrens, who also edited this show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great holiday.